Good morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. We have the tape going now after a few daylight savings times hitches. You will note that the other clock up there still needs to be adjusted. Do we have a quorum yet? Not quite. Okay, well, we're going to get started with the meeting anyway, and we'll officially convene the meeting once we've got the quorum. Two items on the agenda today. First of all, finishing off the testimony from last week with our state economist and the forecast, and then House File 1027. I'm going to go with the forecast first here for 45 minutes or so, and then we'll switch over to House File 1027. And with that, welcome back to the committee, Dr. Colombo-Kitas.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
And, I'm trying to remember exactly where we were with the forecast last week. If you had gotten through all the economic side of it, I guess maybe if you can just give us a five-minute thumbnail sketch, and then we can maybe go to some questions if people have them, because I know there were some last week.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I'm Laura Colombo-Kitas, the state economist, here to talk a bit more about the economy and the budget, the revenue forecast. So we had talked last time about the U.S. economic forecast, and which we received from a macroeconomic forecaster, IHS Economics. And IHS Economics, in their February outlook, had increased their expectations for U.S. real GDP growth relative to what they had in November. So their November outlook informed our November forecast. Their February outlook informed our February forecast. They had an increase in real GDP growth for this year, 2015, that was larger than what they had forecast in November, and that was largely due to a boost in consumer spending, real consumer spending. We talked a bit about the impacts of both the strong dollar, which weakens demand for U.S. exports, and we talked about the lower oil prices, which have the impact of freeing up some money for consumers to spend, but also reducing capital expenditures in oil-related industries. Regarding Minnesota, we talked about how Minnesota's economic expansion continues, that our unemployment rate is a full 2 percentage points below the U.S. rate and is at between the low points of the previous two recessions. The job market in Minnesota has tightened up considerably during 2014, and we in the forecast expect that tightening to translate into wage acceleration, and we have increases in expectations for total salary and wage growth in Minnesota relative to what we had in the November forecast. The increased expectations for wage and salary income growth in 2015 and 2016, and then capital gains growth, especially in 2015, informed the revenue forecast, which brought up our expectations for income taxes relative to what we had in November. And the largest change, dollar amount change in the revenue forecast in the February outlook is in the income tax. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions.
Okay. Any questions for Dr. Colombo-Kitas? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there is a lot of references in the report to oil, and I asked a question about that the last time we were here, but can't help but notice at the gas pump, at least, the prices now seem to be going back up. From less than $2 to, I think, in my neighborhood, $2.39, $2.49 is typical advertisement for gas. If you'd care to comment, because a lot of the reports seem to indicate that that was a real advantage for future economic growth, and are we still seeing the cost per barrel at $40 or whatever it was when you were dealing with the forecast? Now, I do know in watching the news that part of the problem is the refineries and conversions, apparently, according to the news. But having said that, it makes you wonder if we're not going to go be back up to some higher number than what was originally forecasted.
Dr. Colombo-Kitas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the IHS economics forecast for oil had a barrel of Brent crude averaging, I believe, $50 a barrel this year. And I think the lowest prices were going to be the first half of this year. So it's not, we won't know until, you know, getting all the way through the year, how that forecast played out and how correct it was. But you're right that the cost of a barrel of oil is higher at the moment than what IHS had forecast it would be right now. They weren't forecasting that low oil price to stay low forever. They were expecting it to gradually come back up to, I think it was 60 next year, if I remember. I can look at my notes in a moment. And then a gradual increase to $100 a barrel in 2017, I think. So the here it is. So yeah, an average of 50 over this year and a slow ascent to $100 in 2019. Let me correct myself on that. So they weren't expecting it to stay low forever. Indeed, there's also the link between a barrel of oil and the cost of gas, which is not a direct link too, because we've seen the price of gasoline, retail gasoline, tick up in recent weeks on news of problems at refineries, and so the price of gasoline is higher as well than what they had forecast. So the risk in our forecast is whether or not that plays out the way they expected it. We won't know precisely until we followed it for a few more months. So that had, if you recall, the impact of lower retail gasoline prices freeing up consumer spending, and consumer spending increases our sales tax base, which increases sales tax receipts. So there's some risk there. The flip side was that lower oil prices would reduce capital expenditures in oil-related industries, and there might be some negative impact there. We don't think that Minnesota is particularly vulnerable to that effect. Another part of the risk story was the value of the dollar, and that again was a temporary increase, and that carries with it some amount of upside risk, that where if the value of the dollar does not stay high, then that could be beneficial for exports.
Representative Carlson,
If it's $100 a barrel by 2019, I assume it's not going to jump there in one fell swoop, so that's probably right. Going to mean it's going to go up, yes, over time. And I know you did list in the report that was one of the risk factors. I think that's just something that we have to be aware of, because a lot seemed to, when I looked at the report, and when you and I were listening at the Council of Economic Advisors, there was just a lot of discussion about oil and what that meant for the economy, and at least at this point in time, economic growth. I guess how we assess that risk factor in the years ahead between now and 2019, and how rapidly that increase might be, is one of the dilemmas I guess we face when we're projecting a budget into the future. Because I recall we were predicting that the next three biennium we would see significant economic growth, and I was just wondering to what degree, and I guess that's an unanswerable question at this point, the cost of oil might dampen that. But thank you.
Let us take a quick break, Dr. Colombo-Kitas, and I'm going to officially convene the meeting. We do have a quorum. We've got the minutes of the last meeting before us. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes of the last meeting? Seeing none, all in favor, let me have a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Gunther moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Back to you, Dr. Colombo-Kitas. I've got a question. Let me ask. In regard to wages and wage increases, there's been a lot of discussion about that and the fact that we haven't really been seeing wages increase. We're seeing total compensation increase as unemployment goes down, as maybe work week hours start to gradually lengthen. But it is striking to me that we've got a 2% lower unemployment rate in our state compared to the rest of the nation. Are we seeing any more wage increases here in Minnesota than we are nationally? Dr. Kolumbakidis?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just it's a little bit of background just for just to fix ideas here. The wage and salary forecast that we presented and that's in our book, just to be clear, is total wage and salary growth. So it includes that can change with employment growth, and it can change with hours worked. It can change with average hourly wages. So that we do have increased expectations for total annual growth in total wages and salaries. We saw at the end of 2014, based on information from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the quarterly census on employment and wages, and then also our own observations of Minnesota income tax withholding receipts, that 2014 total wage and salary growth was higher in 2014 than what we had previously estimated or forecast in our November forecast. And so that brought up our forecast for wage and salary growth in Minnesota. So have we seen some? We inferred from income tax withholding receipts that indeed total wages and salaries did grow more in Minnesota than what we had anticipated. And that's part of the reason for our increased expectations for 2015 as well. So seeing some of this information from withholding receipts, rather than, I think maybe you might be thinking of, you know, do we see evidence of people getting raises in their average hourly wage, right? Or do we hear of businesses saying we've increased wages? That's not so much what is informed our forecast. Our forecast was informed by the general economic conditions and then observations of withholding receipts. But we have seen evidence from some business surveys, for instance, that employers anticipate having to raise wages this coming year. And so that was something that we took into consideration as well. And just as a quick caveat, we do normally infer from income tax withholding receipts how wages and salaries are growing, but that is not as straightforward as you might think because of differences in how much withholding businesses do. And with the change in the tax law this year, the withholding tables changed for Minnesota. And so I think that particular signal of translating withholding receipts to wage growth, that signal is muddier for us right now than it normally is. So I think there's a little more risk associated with that particular estimate than normal.
Dr. Kolumbakidis, I want to switch then to something else that we've talked about some, and that is when we talk about the forecast, there's always a estimate by our economic forecaster as to the economy and sort of what the chances are that the forecast is maybe going to come in less than expected or better than expected. And it seems to me that one of the biggest things that affects the legislature around here is if the economy heads south and we go into a recession and suddenly we've got receipts coming in a lot less than we expected. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk some about, first of all, what would it mean if we had, say, an average run-of-the-mill recession start, say, a year from now? Not the next great recession, but just an average recession. What would that mean? And maybe talk a little bit about the possibility of somehow adding something to the forecast that would maybe forecast the effects of a recession. Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, It's an important question because the Minnesota's economy is a diverse, robust economy. We have tended through the recent recovery and expansion to outperform the U.S., but the Minnesota economy is highly dependent on the U.S. economy because if you look at the distribution of employment across industrial sectors for Minnesota, it looks a lot like that picture for the United States. Now, that's good in the sense that we have an economy that's almost as diverse as the U.S. economy, and so that makes us resilient, but it also means that we are dependent on what happens in the U.S. economy, which is in turn dependent on what happens in the global economy. So so the risk of a U.S. recession is certainly something that that impacts Minnesota and could potentially impact revenues. So I've given some thought to this. Just again, to fix ideas, revenues don't necessarily fall during a recession, tax revenues, in the sense that they're lower this year than they were last year, although that certainly did happen in the Great Recession. But it is not at all unusual for revenues to fall short of forecast as we enter into a recession. I think that's what you're asking about, Mr. Chairman. So let me also be clear, though, that we do not need to have a recession for revenues to fall short of forecast. In this forecast, for instance, we expect wage and salary income to grow about 5.4% this year. If instead wages grew 1 percentage point less, so 4.4%, income tax liability for tax year 15 would be about $110 million lower than what we have forecast. So that wouldn't be a recession. It would be wages and salaries growing, still growing, but growing less than what we had expected. In addition, you've heard many times me and my predecessor, Professor Stinson, talk about the volatility of capital gains income. So if capital gains income does not grow as fast as forecast, that can cause big swings as well. And slower growth in the current year compounds, so we lower the base of wages and then or capital gains, and that compounds over the coming years. So it's an important risk. So we started thinking a bit about the impact of a recession. We started thinking about it in the same context as our budget reserve analysis that we do once a year to look at the risk to the revenue system of the volatility of the revenue system, and what would the budget reserve have to be to make sure that we could cover a downfall. And so if we sort of isolate the threat of a recession from other kinds of risks, and if you assume a recession will occur say approximately every 8 to 10 years, which it varies a lot when you look over the history of recessions, but if you assume you get a recession approximately every 8 to 10 years, then to ensure a reserve, so a way to think about this is how much reserve would we have to have in order to be adequate to cover a recession induced shortfall, we'd need up to about 2.6% of biennial revenues, or for a recession that occurs 8 to 10 years, between $900 million and $1.1 billion. So that's the way we've been thinking about the risk of a recession. Is what kind of a reserve would you have to cover the likely revenue loss? And that's that's a very rough estimate.
Well, to that point, though, Dr. Kolumbakidis, I mean, haven't we the last few recessions seen budget deficits far larger than that, even leaving aside the Great Recession? I mean, I remember going back to the early 2000s, I think that one was a $4.5 billion shortfall with an economy that's obviously quite a bit smaller than today, and I think even going earlier, it would have been bigger than that. Are you saying that you think that the budget reserve we have now is adequate to handle a recession without other big changes by us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the budget reserve we have now is not up to the level that we recommend based on our report of revenue volatility. And so that's taking the report on revenue volatility takes into consideration all the risks, including forecast risk. Let me restate that. It takes into consideration the risks associated with revenue volatility. And we recommend a level of reserves that is for the 16-17 biennium would be 5.2% of biennial revenues, which is 2 point something billion. So setting that aside, though, but using the same thought process, if you wanted to isolate the risk of a recession, then we have the numbers that I just gave you. That does not mean that it's all based on probabilities and statistics, and we certainly could, we could well have changes in revenues that exceed that. We could easily have changes in revenues that exceed that. We have seen changes in revenues that exceed that. And as I said when I began my comments, you don't even need a recession to see the changes in revenues of that amount. So I'll leave it at that.
And Dr. Kolomakidis, how hard would it be to do a forecast that, say, looked at the part of the forecast that was forecasting the more pessimistic economic scenario and just say, all right, going forward, instead of going with the middle scenario for the budget forecast, let's say what would happen if the pessimistic scenario hit? How hard would it be to add that information in somehow?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the committee members who don't follow this as closely, the IHS Economics, the macroeconomic forecaster who provides us with the U.S. economic outlook, provides us a baseline outlook. So this is the outlook that they think is going to happen. And then they provide us with an optimistic scenario and a pessimistic scenario. And so all of the variables that are in the baseline outlook are in both of those scenarios. And then they explain in their narrative what how they would expect the pessimistic scenario to play out or the optimistic scenario to play out. So they say, for instance, in this particular forecast, I think it was the housing market not recovering as quickly and global growth being slower would lead to their pessimistic scenario. And then they assign a probability to each of those, which was 15% in this outlook, leaving 70% for the baseline. So we employ the baseline macroeconomic forecast in making our forecast, but there's a lot of, it's not as though we have a single model of Minnesota's revenues and we'd simply plug in the U.S. macroeconomic variables to get our revenue forecast. We're forecasting a number of different revenue sources and different approaches for each of those revenue sources, different models for each of those revenue sources, and each of those models uses different variables out of the IHS economics forecast. We do use the IHS economics forecast to create our Minnesota economic forecast, we also include in that Minnesota-specific information about employment and other industrial sectors. And that model uses a variety of the U.S. macro variables. So it would not be a trivial exercise for us to do the baseline forecast and do an alternative forecast. It's really all we can do with the resources we have to do the forecast that we have, and then use our judgment and the judgment of the Council of Economic Advisors as to whether the macroeconomic forecast that we're using is reasonable, and then provide all of you with as much information we can about the associated risks. If we think that some of the events, for instance, that are described in IHS economics pessimistic scenario are things that we think are particularly important to Minnesota, then we may well think about how to incorporate that information into our Minnesota model and our Minnesota revenues.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. The Chair just spent a lot of time asking about what if a recession was to happen and how you would forecast the what if. Mm-hmm. So although I suspect the question I'm going to ask would require you to get paid an awful lot more money, what's your ability to predict a recession? And what's the likelihood of you being right predicting a recession? And that's why I went to the higher pay grade.
Dr. Colombo-Kitas.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, I'm not the only economist who doesn't forecast recessions very often. The nature of macroeconomic forecasting is that we macroeconomists tend not to anticipate a downturn. What they do is what IHS does, which is says, here's what we think is the most likely scenario. And we're going to say we're 70% confident that this scenario is going to happen. But we also see these risks on the horizon. And here's the likelihood we think of these bad things happening. And sometimes that pessimistic scenario involves a forecast. We tend not to forecast that a recession is going to happen in 2016, a recession is going to happen in 2017. What is more likely is we'll see some things happening that look like slowing down of GDP growth and maybe contraction, and then observe that. But you need to observe that for a while, actually, because, for instance, a year ago, early 2014, in the first quarter, we had a contraction, a real GDP contraction. And everybody observed it and described what they thought was going on. But almost nobody said, contraction, that means we're going to have subsequent, a whole bunch of other contractions, and we're going to see a recession. So we're looking at the whole picture. What's the probability of my being able to forecast a recession and being right? It's pretty low.
Representative Mahoney.
And thank you, Doctor. And Mr. Chair, thank you for another question here. The Chair spoke to trying to put and then you elaborated on the pessimistic outcomes of a recession, and you may be the wrong person to ask this question, but most businesses that are successful really look at a recession as an opportunity to invest in places and things and infrastructure in their corporation or their company so that they are poised to do better once they come out of a recession. So it would be nice to understand when a recession is coming so that we as state government could figure out what's the best way to handle that and make the investments, whether it's infrastructure improvements because costs are much lower during a recession than they are during a big upswing like today, mm-hmm. or software for our computer systems to make it easier for our consumers to interact with government. So, well, I don't think that's a fair question. I guess I'll just make it as a statement that, mm-hmm. that although it is good to understand when a recession is coming, it's also really good to understand that when we are in a contraction, we need to be just like a business and look at the opportunities there, whether it's infrastructure investment or retrenching, as I think somebody was trying to implicate.
I have Representatives Albright, Druskowski, and Detmer. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Doctor. You spoke just recently about the concern or the risk that the wages don't increase at the rate that IHS or that the state model, you know, suggests. And so it's kind of a two-part question that I'm going to pose to you in terms of, one is, there is a ripple effect to the economy if wages do not increase at the rate that either IHS or the state model projects, because that also reflects, because we are a consumer-driven economy, it reflects negatively upon business expansion to the point that Representative Mahoney brings up in terms of the desire for expansion. But yet, if their own forecasts are incumbent upon what the overall state economy projects, they're going to retrench and hunker down until a more favorable light. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, if you will. So to you, I would pose In light of recent events, we've all heard in the paper about some layoffs, particularly of notable Fortune 100 companies that are stationed in Minnesota. Does that concern you as the state, from a state perspective, because we are potentially seeing a bit of a domino effect in terms of layoffs and what happens to those people looking for new jobs that are, when we are in a rise in terms of reduction in unemployment, but we have new people looking for new jobs? If you could speak to that, and then to the extent that labor participation rates are included in the state's model in terms of the virtue or the value of the jobs that are being created. Could you just speak to that possibly?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so the beginning of your question had to do with ripple effects or sort of multiplier impacts of changes in wages, and indeed our revenue, when we our forecast for wages impacts our forecast for income tax receipts because it's income, but it also can influence our forecast for the sales tax because it can affect consumer spending, and so we're paying attention to all of those interactions when we're doing our forecast. I can't remember which briefing it was on forecast day, but someone had asked me about industrial sectors that I was concerned about or interested in or paying attention to. I can't remember if I talked about the management of companies sector, but that's the subsector of professional and business services that includes people who work at our corporate headquarters. And so we had indeed been watching that sector and had seen some reduction in employment in that sector relative to the U.S., so our share relative to the U.S. over time. And we understood that some of that may have been due to layoffs that we already had known about, but that sector was on our watch list, and we have in the forecast some continued reduction in that sector during the first part of this year, but then in the forecast we have it employment in that sector leveling off and increasing. So that all of the activity in among the people who work for our corporate headquarters, whether it's increases or decreases, that was all part of the forecast. What I think about the recent changes and layoffs from corporate headquarters in Minnesota is it's an important test of the economy that we've been talking about. So we've been talking about a broad-based economy in Minnesota that has employment activity across the board, which improves the resilience of the economy during downturns, so that when one sector contracts, there are other jobs for people to get. And the management of company sector in particular, and professional business services a little bit broader, is quite important in that way, because those firms all share occupational needs. Okay, so somebody who's a marketer for one corporate headquarters may well be able to get a job being a marketer for another one, and so that I think that sharing of professional needs and professional skills across firms is one of the strengths of this economy. So releasing the number of people that we've heard about in the last week, we don't know exactly how many people, but releasing that number of people into this economy is going to be a test of that resilience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mm-hmm.
Harkening back to the chair's discussion about wages and median family wages, and you and I talked about this a little bit at the forecast briefing, but mm-hmm. Over the last two biennia, as we know, our state government has operated on an approach where we have grown government significantly each of those two biennia in raising taxes and the pressure on the private sector in order to fund that larger government, while in many other states they've gone a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
The Census Bureau tells us that the median family income nationwide has increased between 2007 and 2013 by somewhere around $4,200 or $4,300 per family. In Minnesota, it's decreased between the same time period, 2007 to 2013, by $4,320 per family. My question to you is, given the fact that the median family income seems to be growing nationwide at a fairly good rate, while decreasing at about the same rate in Minnesota. So the question is, have you seen the 2014 data yet, actual data, maybe the data that would eventually be reported to the Census Bureau, because the last time I looked it wasn't available yet for 2014. Is that data available yet? Have we seen anything? Have we seen anything, any actual data that has shown we're actually reversing the downward trend of median family income that families in Minnesota are experiencing?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, I don't think I've seen any preliminary 2014 median income data, although it's possible that something was, and I would direct you to the state demographer's office for information like that. Anything coming from the census, our state demographer can help you with that. It's possible that we got something from her office that's incorporated, but that I just don't recall or can't put my finger on. But I certainly can't say anything about that preliminary data right now. And I think there was a question last time I was before this committee about wage and salary growth, and that, and that your question is related to this, is that this aggregate growth that we forecast does not tell you anything about the distribution of income. And so it doesn't tell you what's happening to the median, because total wages and salaries could grow because everybody's income stayed the same, but one family's income went way up. So so I think it is worthwhile to look at those kinds of metrics and look at the distribution of income. But our forecast cannot tell you that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Dittmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Kolumbakidis. Let's take a broader look in terms of the world economy, and what would happen if, say, we had another 9/11, well, heaven forbid, and how that affected not only our national economy but our state economic outlook. What would happen if, say, if something happened in the Middle East with Iran, Israel, and so forth, and we got are involved in that? Has your office ever looked at how something like that might affect us?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, a major geopolitical event, a major international event, could have the impact on the U.S. economy that the prior event had. We had that happen. We did not anticipate it. It triggered, the U.S. economy was in the circumstances where it helped to trigger the Great Recession, and the subsequent events. So I can't speculate about what a hypothetical international event would do to the U.S. economy, except to reiterate, or to the Minnesota economy, except to reiterate, one, that Minnesota's economy is very dependent on the U.S. economy. So if there's a major geopolitical event that causes major disruption in the U.S. economy, that's going to be felt here. We are not above anything like that. We know that we are not as vulnerable to some kinds of risks as some other states. For instance, the challenges associated with federal fiscal policy and the fiscal cliff, and the federal government shutdown, and those kinds of things don't affect Minnesota quite as much. But in our forecast document and in IHS's narratives, there's always discussion of international unrest and geopolitical risk, and those things are certainly not for me to forecast or anticipate, but a major event that affects the U.S. economy is going to be felt all over Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, that's one area that if you look at the those organizations outside our country that are trying to bring havoc within our country, that's the economic situation is one area that they would definitely attack. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, let's go back to gas. As gas goes up, under the governor's proposal, a 6.5% increase on the wholesale level of gas. At $2, that's 13 cents. At $3 gas, it's 19 cents approximately. Certainly at $4 gas, which is reasonable the way you were describing it in the future, that would be 24 cents, the top of our 28 cents we presently have, and federal government's 18. Can the average family that has to commute back and forth to work afford a tax that severe?
Dr. Kalambokidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, our revenue forecast is a current law forecast, and so it does not include any impacts of any proposals, including the gas tax proposal that you're talking about. So you'd have to look at it as our forecast is our best guess about how the economy and the revenues play out given current law. So we are not estimating what happens if any particular proposal comes true. But we've talked earlier about the risk in the forecast of changes in gas prices, and if there are changes in gas prices due to anything, including geopolitical risk, changes in refineries, increases in taxes, then that's going to impact consumer spending. And I would just want to follow up a little bit to the earlier questions about risk and how important it is for you to be having this conversation and thinking about all of those things, because I think I may have said this on forecast day, but the next biennium forecast, the FY16-17 revenue forecast, that's for a biennium that hasn't even started yet. And we're 29 months out to the end of that. And a lot of things can happen. You've already identified a lot of the kinds of things that can happen between now and then. And think back to last summer when we didn't even anticipate these things that we're talking about now. We didn't anticipate the big dip in oil prices, and nobody knew how far it would go. And as we've already talked about, nobody's quite sure how far it's going to come back up or how quickly. We didn't anticipate the increase in the value of the dollar and how that's going to play out. And so it's hard to anticipate what's going to happen from one year to the next, which is a reason to be focusing on these kinds of risks, including the risk of a recession, but all sorts of risks that could occur even in the absence of recession.
I have Representatives Garofalo and Liebling, and then I think at that point we're going to move on to the next item of business. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, for being here. Doctor, can you please translate, or can you please talk to us about the correlation between the improvements in the economy and household formation? There's a note on page 2 about this where it says, first, stronger labor market conditions must begin to translate into improvements in household formation. Can you talk about the historical correlation of that and why it's necessary for economic growth going forward?
Dr. Kalambokidis.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, we discuss in the forecast book some of the dependencies to our forecast. So what our forecast depended on, what are some of the assumptions we made or some of some of our thought processes. And so if those things don't play out, the forecast won't necessarily play out. And one of the things we talked about was this the wage growth that we're expecting to draw some people into the labor market, so pull in some of the remaining labor market slack that we have in Minnesota, and also for those improvements to improve household formation. And so households form when people who have been living together during a downturn in order to save money, their opportunities improve, and so they decide to move out on their own. So the classic example is the college student who's living in mom and dad's basement and then finally gets a good enough job to get an apartment of his or her own. And so that general labor market conditions and general economic conditions are positively correlated with household formations. So as we move through recovery and an expansion, household formations typically increase, holding population growth constant. But with population growth, then household formations can increase with that too, with population growth. And then during a downturn, household formations tend to go down. The reason household formations are important is because it drives or informs the demand for housing and can improve the demand for both existing homes, increasing the price of existing homes, and the demand for new homes and new apartments, and so that improves the construction forecast. So we in particular use household formations to inform our housing market forecast, which informs our construction employment forecast. So when those links don't occur, when those that growth doesn't occur, that means we would have fewer people employed in the construction sector than what we are forecasting. The housing market in Minnesota and in the United States in 2014 was disappointing. It did not grow as fast as expected. We know now that we had below average household formations from 2013 to 2014, and so that helps explain that disappointing growth.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've had a lot of questions this morning about what would happen if we were attacked, what would happen if we had this increase in the gas tax. And I wonder if you've done any kind of analysis on what would happen if our infrastructure continues to crumble. So, say another bridge would fall down because it wasn't maintained properly or wasn't inspected, or say that Minnesotans who can't afford a car or who can't drive are unable to get to their school or work because there isn't enough mass transit for them. Or say Minnesotans, the time they waste sitting in traffic because our roads are inadequate or because there isn't enough transit. Or the impact of consumers who have to spend money replacing tires or fixing their suspension because they hit a bunch of potholes. Do you factor any of that into your calculations? Do you have any way to predict the impediment to our economy of not replacing our infrastructure?
Dr. Colombo-Kitas.
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, we don't separately estimate that or do impact analysis of any kind for any specific kind of impact like that. But I can say that one of the things that that is that we've talked about for a while, and again you heard from my predecessor about too, one of the limiting factors on the U.S. economy and Minnesota's economy is slowing labor force growth due to demographic change. And that means that for Minnesota to thrive in the future, we'll need to improve labor productivity in order to produce the same amount of stuff with a smaller growing number of people. One of the ways to improve productivity, we certainly can talk about education and health, which are obvious ways, but infrastructure development is one of the ways that can improve labor productivity that we don't talk about quite as much, because you're getting people more quickly from place to place improves their ability to work. Another thing that we've talked about is the tightening of the labor market in Minnesota and pretty limited labor market slack or labor force slack, or so people who are unemployed and or underemployed. One of the things that employers are trying to figure out now is how to attract the labor force that they need. So we've heard about particular challenges in different parts of Minnesota where employers are saying we're having a hard time getting people here. So being able to move workers, whether it's within a region or across the state, being able to move workers from where they are to where the jobs are is something that's going to matter too. And then I would add that one of the sectors, I talked about the diverse economy, we have an important goods-producing sector in Minnesota. So we have manufacturing, we have agriculture, we have mining and logging. And all of those sectors matter. They all matter because they export goods and bring money into the state. But they also matter because they're moving goods, inputs and outputs, so the things they use to make goods and then the finished products and the commodities around the state. And being able to move those commodities and those finished goods and those inputs around the state is very important to that sector.
people. Dr. Kalamakidis, thank you again for your testimony and for being here with the Ways and Means Committee again today, as well as last week. We appreciate your work on behalf of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, next we're going to take up House File 1027, and Representative Garofalo will proceed up to the stand. Members, I'd call your attention to the fiscal note on House File 1027, which is why we're talking about House File 1027. It's not a real big fiscal note, but it is still a fiscal note with some cost that we need to consider. Representative Garofalo moves that House File 1027 be referred to the General Register. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And first of all, I want to thank members on both sides of the aisle for either co-sponsoring or supporting this legislation. As everyone knows, the only way a bill becomes a law this session is if members of both the Republican, both legislative members of the Republican and DFL caucuses vote for this bill. And regardless of how members feel about this bill today, as this bill moves forward, please know that my door is open. If there are things I can do to improve the bill to gain the support of additional DFL members, I'm open to doing that, keeping in mind the fact that, again, the only way a bill is going to become a law is with bipartisan support. Mr. Chairman and members, three things to know about this bill. Number one is it only applies to those who are making in excess of $12 an hour. Two, that it builds off of an existing two-tiered minimum wage that is in law right now regarding certain resort owners in northern Minnesota. And third and finally, that what this the intent of this bill is to retain and preserve those jobs that are in the table service, table dining industry. Right now, we have an unintended regulatory preference that we are giving away from tipped restaurants and employees. Simply put, under current law, the government mandates that those making $12 an hour get a government-mandated wage increase, while those who are making $9 an hour do not get an increase. If the stated purpose of the minimum wage law is to give a wage increase to those who make the least, that is simply doesn't make sense to apply it to those who are making more, working more than $12 an hour. So, Mr. Chairman and members, this is the two-tiered minimum wage bill. Again, it is not a tip penalty. It is not a tip credit bill. Those are different structures. This is a requirement that, again, a person has to be making over $12 an hour for this provision to apply to it. And, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Members, I've also got the one person that did request to testify. I've got Jennifer Schaubach from the AFL-CIO testifying in opposition that had requested. We've had a lot of testimony on this bill, so I don't want to take a lot of testimony on it, but I am required to take testimony if people ask by House rules or at least some testimony. And I guess, members, does someone have a particular question for Representative Garofalo on his introduction? Well, I'll recognize Representative Hillstrom. She was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo. This has to do with business, and it has an impact not only on wait staff, but also on valet services, hotel lodging, delivery drivers, cosmetology services, and who often employ tipped wages, according to the fiscal note. My question is, why didn't this go to Commerce?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as the enforcement of the policies and procedures of the Department of Labor and Industry, are no longer in the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, so this doesn't have anything to do with commerce in Minnesota?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, it does have to do with commerce, but again, the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and Industry is now under the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee. It's no longer under the Commerce Committee as it has been in previous sessions.
Mr. Chair.
Last question on that, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill previously has gone to Commerce. I believe it should have gone to Commerce, and so I would make a motion to send this bill to Commerce, and I would ask for a roll call.
Representative Hillstrom moves that House File 1027 be referred to the Commerce Committee. Discussion on that motion. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as I've stated before, the jurisdictions of the committee are different than they were in the previous legislative session. This jurisdiction is under the Job Growth Committee.
All right. Any other discussion to the motion to send House File 1027 to Commerce? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, has the chairman of the Commerce Committee, Representative Hoppe, requested this bill?
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, no, he has not, and I've talked to him about it, and he does not see the need for the Commerce Committee to hear this bill.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the motion to send House File 1027 to the Commerce Committee.
Knobloch?
No.
Albright?
No.
Anderson? Carlson?
Aye.
Cornish?
No.
Davids?
No.
Dean?
No.
Detmer?
No.
Raskowski?
No.
Garofalo?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Heckbarth?
Absent.
Hamilton?
No.
Hillstrom?
Aye.
Weinstein?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Pinchesky? Liebling?
Yes.
Noon?
No.
Mahoney?
Yes.
McNamara?
No.
Murphy?
Yes.
Nornes?
No.
Pulowski? Bobby? Torkelson? Erdahl?
No.
And Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 8 affirmative votes and 14 negative votes, the motion does not prevail. The bill is not referred to the Commerce Committee. With that, members, I think I'd like to call Jennifer Schaubach forward for the testimony that she would like to give. Representative Kahn.
I actually just had a question on the last one of the last statements that the author made.
All right. Representative Kahn, while Jennifer's coming up.
Okay. I didn't understand your statement that this is not a bill dealing with tip credit. I don't understand what else it deals with.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, other states deploy a tip credit mechanism where tipped wages are used to get a person up to the statutory minimum wage level. So, for example, they may have a tipped minimum wage of $3 an hour, and then their tipped wages are used to get them up to whatever that statutory level is, $7 or $8. What this proposal does is say that you are guaranteed the $8 an hour minimum wage. However, if you are in excess of $8 an hour, if you are in excess of $12 an hour, you're not going to get that government-mandated increase to $9 that's taking place in August. So again, you would have to be, the only way this applies is if you're making in excess of $12 an hour.
Okay. I still, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I guess I just don't understand the language. It seems to me it clearly is not
Representative
what you say it is.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how quickly you plan on moving, but I want to make sure that we have a roll call vote when you bring the bill up for passage.
All right. Well, I am anticipating that we'll have a vote on the bill today, so we'll have a roll call vote on the bill today then, Representative Carlson. All right. Ms. Schaubach?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. And good morning, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working people throughout the state. And I am here today to testify in opposition to House File 1027. Chris Jacobs from Jobs Now Coalition was unable to be here today, but she wanted me to recognize Representative Mary Murphy and honor her for her work in the past. Two servers since 1984, and also led the successful campaign to get rid of the tip penalty back then. So thank you, Representative Murphy. There's been a lot of talk here about how this works, that it's not a tip penalty, that it's not a tip credit. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that we need to talk about and how confusing this is going to be for not only the workers, but the businesses. And the impact this is going to have on small restaurants, the mom-and-pop shops that we're always talking about, this is very serious. In other states that allow for a sub-minimum wage, like Representative Garofalo said, a tipped worker's tips plus their base wage base or tipped wage must equal at least their state's regular minimum wage. If not, the employer has to make it up. However, our bill does not require the employer to make up any difference. So it's not going to require, or it's not going to say every server is going to make $12 an hour. It just says if they don't make $12 an hour, what varies is their hourly rate. So if I don't make $4 an hour in tips in any one of my shifts on average, then I would make the higher minimum wage rate. If not, I keep at $8 an hour. Now, this regulation is and will be extremely difficult to implement in practice, both because it is logistically difficult to do so and because it would be up to the worker to request that her employer make up the higher wage rate if they don't make the $12 an hour with their wages plus tips. So another issue with the bill, to determine compliance with Federal Labor Standards Act wage requirements in other states that have a tip penalty, the total of tips plus the subminimum wage is to be assessed on a work week basis. A work week is defined as any fixed and regularly recurring 168-hour period. But many tip workers work irregular schedules, and the practical implementation of this regulation is unclear. At what point does an employer stop the clock to tally up hours, tips, and base wages? Compliance is difficult to assess, even if a good faith employer would like to do so. The language in House File 1027 does not base it on a work week, it works it on a pay period. So say you work 2 weeks. 1 week is over New Year's Eve. Anybody who's ever worked in the restaurant business or some holiday, you know that you have higher tips when there's holidays and the following week is less. So when does that employer, when are they supposed to actually look at those, that average? Moreover, a tipped employee seeking to monitor their employer's compliance with the law would need to record their hours for the determined work week, erratic schedules notwithstanding, record all tips they receive, and how employees should treat tips shared with other staff, such as restaurant bussers or barbacks, and this calculation is also unclear. Record the base wage they were paid from their employer and calculate if the effective hourly rate equaled the required state or, you know, the $12 an hour. If not, this employee would have to approach the employer to seek the missing pay. Of course, this is the same employer who determines whether this employee will be given the most lucrative shifts, the best restaurant sections in the case of waiters and waitresses, or if the employee will retain her job, his or her job at all. It is unrealistic to think that a tipped employee dealing with an unscrupulous employer would be able to reclaim their lost wages, let alone confront someone with such power over their near-term financial health. Indeed, the restaurant industry is fraught with violations. In the most recent 2010-2012 compliance sweep of nearly 9,000 full-service restaurants by the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division, 83.8% of investigated restaurants had some type of violation. In total, Wage and Hour Division recovered $56.8 million in back wages for nearly 82,000 workers and assessed $2.5 million in civil penalties. Violations included 1,170 tip penalty infractions that resulted in nearly $5.5 million in back wages. Tipped work is one of the lowest paid occupations, in addition to being one of the fastest growing. This tip penalty will undermine the impact of the minimum wage increase we passed in 2014. A tip penalty will further entrench the depressing poverty rate of women working in restaurants, a rate which is three times higher than even men in the same industry. A tip penalty will intensify the wage theft crisis. In states with tip penalties, the employer is legally required to pay the difference, like we said. Despite this, 26% of workers still don't earn the legal minimum wage because these laws are replete with loopholes, frequently broken, and rarely enforced. Public enforcement of wage and hour laws cannot keep up with violations. On the federal level, the U.S. Department of Labor, which is responsible for enforcing federal wage, child labor, and other labor laws, has just over 1,000 investigators nationwide who are tasked with enforcing these laws in more than 1 million workplaces. Because of these scarce resources, the average employer has just a 1 in 1,000th chance of being investigated by USDOL, Wage and Hour Division, or OSHA.
Excuse me, Ms. Schaubach, do you have any, regarding the, I mean, you're talking about enforcement, and that's what the fiscal note is about. Do you have any particular comments to the fiscal note?
Getting to that right now, sir.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, thus, the chance of getting caught, let alone having to pay back wages owed, are so remote that most wage cheats don't have to think twice about the consequences of breaking the law. Things aren't any better at the state level. According to a nationwide survey, states have the equivalent of one inspector for every 146,000 workers. Most states have fewer than 10 investigators. We have 6. And that's after adding 1.5 last session for WESA compliance. So we have 6 investigators to enforce all wage and hour. Private enforcement, such as private lawsuits, is rarely an option for low-wage workers to recover the wages due to them. Limited damages they would recover combined with the time and expense in filing a lawsuit mean that these workers can seldom find lawyers to find their case. With over 10,000 restaurants and 48,000 servers in Minnesota, Minnesota AFL-CIO and its affiliates feel that the passage and implementation of House File 1027 has a much greater cost that can be reflected in any fiscal note. Not just to the employers, who will have to acquire the necessary technology to track and report this very confusing policy, but most notably the cost to the thousands of Minnesotans whose wages will be cut, capped, and frozen with this tip penalty. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Schaubach. I did have one person that had contacted me about possibly testifying in favor of it. Mr. McElroy, did you still want to testify?
Yes, please.
All right.
Before Mr. McElroy comes down, can I just offer?
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Garofalo.
Sure. Just three quick points, Mr. Chairman. First of all, members of the committee, if you look on page 3 of the bill, you'll see that those that are represented by collective bargaining units are excluded from the statute, so it does not apply to them. Second of all, you'll also notice that this is not a mandate. If an employer wants to pay the higher minimum wage, they're certainly allowed to. So in terms of any mandates on employers, it doesn't exist that way. And third and finally, I would point out to members of the committee that we already have a two-tiered minimum wage in law. It became law last session. The AFL-CIO voted for that provision. And so the fact that there's already a two-tiered minimum wage in law is pretty evidence that there must not be too much of a burdensome regulation or a talking point against it.
Okay, I'm going to recognize Mr. McElroy, and then we'll take questions. Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Restaurant Association and the Minnesota Lodging Association. Thank you for the opportunity to make some comments. We believe that this proposal is a creative, kind of Minnesota-only solution to trying to maintain a large number of high-paying tip jobs in Minnesota, but recognize the economics. As little as 7 years ago, half the volume in the restaurant business was done at table service restaurants. According to a study done by Nation's Restaurant News in 2013, that had fallen to about a third of total volume done in full service restaurants. The balance done in quick service or fast casual or buffets or in other service styles. And the good paying, great paying tipped employee jobs that we have are largely in table service restaurants. We did a survey in January 2013 of our members, more than 100 companies, several hundred locations, and found that the average tipped employee with their hourly wage and their reported tips earned about $18 an hour on a statewide basis and about $22 an hour in the metro area. We've recently repeated that research. I don't have the new numbers. We'll have them shortly to make that announcement. We know what has happened in other states that have had an increasing minimum wage and have not recognized that tips are income or that tip jobs are important. In the states of Washington and Oregon, prior to their beginning to raise their minimum wage above federal levels, they averaged, according to numbers created by the U.S. Census Bureau and a study called the Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages, almost 19 jobs per restaurant, exactly where Minnesota is today. Since they have moved up and gone to 950, their average employee per restaurant has fallen to about 14.8 employees per restaurant. And if Washington and Oregon had the number of employees per establishment they had 5 years ago, they'd have about 40,000 more jobs. If we fall by 4.5 employees per restaurant over 5 years, and the reason that has happened in Washington and Oregon is really three phenomena. One is greater automation of the order entry process using smartphone applications and tablet computers and kiosks, and changing the ordering style from ordering at your table to ordering at a counter. There's some automation in the kitchen, not a lot. We don't see why, and some of this automation will come anyway, but it's come much faster in states that don't recognize tips or income. And Ms. Staubach made some specific suggestions that I think may be helpful. Employers already reported tips for IRS purposes and because they are wages for every purpose. And we could do it on a weekly basis easily. We have talked about guaranteeing a $12 wage for those who meet the definition of a table server. It would be more challenging to do that for limousine drivers or cosmetologists. We also don't think it's as helpful to our employees. If under that scenario, a server made $11.40 an hour in a particular week, the employer would make up 60 cents. Under our bill, they would increase compensation by a dollar in 2015 following August 1 and a dollar and a half following August 16, which we think is better for our employees. This is not going to be a challenge to administer. I have talked to payroll services and software providers and employers, and there are much more complex pay schemes in healthcare involving shift differentials and style of work differentials, and in construction involving, again, shift differentials and high floor pay and a variety of other things. The vast majority of our members and the restaurants that we know either use a payroll service, and we have talked to all of them, or software like QuickBooks or Peachtree, all of which has the easy ability to model this. We're supportive of rigorous enforcement. We think the fiscal note is a reasonable one. We believe that this can protect good-paying jobs in Minnesota, maintain the option of table service in a wide variety of places that might otherwise disappear, and that this is a uniquely Minnesota solution to a long-standing problem, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. All right, I have Representative Wagenius, Hillstrom, Murphy, Mahoney, and Carlson. Unless Lead Carlson, did you have something you wanted to
bring up? The others may make some of the same points that
I would like to make, so I'll just adjust my comments accordingly.
All right, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, earlier in this committee hearing, we heard from the state economist, and one of the issues that we chatted about was the middle class. And when we were in committee earlier, I asked you if you knew how many people would slip out of the middle class with your bill. And you didn't know that number at that time. Do you know that number now?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, again, this provision only applies to those who are making in excess of $12 an hour. The concerns you're expressing about slipping out of the middle class, again, if someone falls below $12 an hour, they will still get the government-mandated wage increase. And again, I would point out, Representative Wagenius, that the two-tiered minimum wage is already in law. It's a provision that you voted for and already accounts for the total cost of an ownership for an employee. And that's a provision that was enacted just last year for the very first time. So I understand your concerns. If there are changes I can make to the bill to gain your support, my door remains open. However, I do not. I don't think you had. I don't think people had that concern when they passed the two-tiered minimum wage last session, and I don't think it's a reasonable concern now.
Representative Wienis.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to follow up. If I recall what we passed last year, it had to do with folks who had an additional benefit or benefits, lodging, food. So I don't see that that is a reasonable comparison here. You might see differently, but I'm still trying to get at the question of how many people who are in the middle class, and these are predominantly women, and that is especially concerning. How many do we know the outcome of this bill? And that's what I'm trying to get at.
Representative Garofalo, do you have any other comment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Genius, I'm confused by your comment because you're so the employer should get credit for the food and lodging benefit they give employees, but they should not be given credit for the wages they give employees?
Representative Genius?
You know, that's last year's bill. I don't think that is the issue to get into right now. I mean, that's last year's. That has happened. We see that differently. I'm talking about this year's bill and the very fundamental question of how many people will be slipping out of the middle class with your bill, and what's the number? What is the population we're talking about here?
Representative Garofalo, anything else, or I'll recognize Representative Hillstrom?
No, just, Mr. Chairman, if there's concerns from members of the DFL caucus about that section of law, if you're asking me to delete that provision from law, I'll do it. I'll add that as an amendment to the bill. So.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, it's clear that the majority of service workers in Minnesota are women, and changing this will not do one thing to eliminate the income gap between men and women. But I'm particularly concerned about other behaviors that happen in the service industry. So, for example, some restaurants require the employee who gets their tips on a credit card to pay the service fee of the credit card for the entire bill. So does that tip minus the service charge count towards the income calculation, or does the entire tip and then the employer can still reduce the amount by the service charge count? So as you're calculating how we come up with this $12 an hour. In many restaurants, you have to tip the bar as the server. You have to tip the person working at the bar in order to get them to provide your drinks for you. If you have to share your tips as part of the system that's in operation, does all of that income count towards the server, or do they get to reduce their cost of service from their amount of income as it's calculated? Representative Garofalo, I think first going to a tip-type credit is the wrong thing, but I think this is particularly complicated in how you're going to calculate it. So I'd like some real-life examples of how this is going to work.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, there's three questions in there, and I'll address each of them. First of all, with regards to the credit card service charge, I think it's a reasonable concern. This Wednesday, the Job Growth Committee will be hearing a bill offered by Representative Dabney on just that issue, and my door is open about having a conversation about addressing that issue. Second of all, you brought up the idea of arrangements of sharing tips or forced pooling of tips. To point out to members of the committee that that is illegal under Minnesota state law. You cannot require staff to share tips with other employees. It's already illegal. I can't make it doubly illegal under this bill. So that is just not something that's legal under current Minnesota law to force employees to share their tips. And third and finally, with regards to the concern about the wage gap that you mentioned, as we heard from Mr. McElroy, my concern is that we don't provide a regulatory preference to eliminate table service dining. We know that that is the most labor-intensive type of dining. That's the one that's going to have the highest paid jobs. And my intent here is to preserve those jobs and make sure that they stay in Minnesota, not that they, not that we follow the mistakes of other states.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, one last follow-up. I've got a lot of other people that would like to ask questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a final comment. Representative Garofalo, we've actually had growth in this area in Minnesota, and I don't think that $18,000 a year is too high of a wage to pay service workers. And on average, if you're paid with the minimum wage increase, according to this, it's about $18,000 per year, and I don't think that that is too high of a wage.
Mr. Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, do you acknowledge that under current law, we are imposing a government-mandated wage increase for those who make over $12 an hour, while we are not doing the same thing for those who make $9.50 an hour?
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would acknowledge that we are requiring people to pay a minimum wage. And if you're a tipped employee and you're a good one, you may make a little bit more. But we are requiring a minimum wage in Minnesota, and I think that's the right thing to do.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, how was the $12 and is it $8 decided on?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the $8 is the current minimum wage in statute. The $12 is a 50% increase above that.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, what is the for the small employer, what is the difference?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you look in the bill, you can see what existing statute is. The definition of a small employer for sales made or business done less than $500,000, that is listed on the top or the bottom of page one. It shows what the phase-in approach is for those.
Representative Murphy, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I don't understand. As I understand this, the $12 is how much the employer-employee sets as the standard wage. If a person makes the $8 more than $12, then the employer only has to pay $8 of that $12. Is that correct?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it depends upon which section of law they are covered by. Again,
we're talking about the large employer.
Okay, for large employers, that would be correct. It would be Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that would be correct. But I would point out that there are, if you look at page 2, line 13, this is the existing two-tiered minimum wage that's in law. And so if a large employer meets those designations of a hotel or motel lodging establishment, then they would not apply to that's a specific provision that applies to them. So I want to make sure I'm being clear that it's not just every large employer does not pay that rate under current law.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Garofalo, when we heard the previous testifier talk a little bit about the ability of the state and federal government to enforce wage theft statutes. Minnesota, and I was very happy last year in the jobs bill to put one and a half more inspectors on, because wage theft is a huge problem in this state. It is becoming more and more of a problem. And your bill really increases that. Because what many people didn't catch is that this is a complaint-based system. So if I feel that my employer is not paying me what was promised, I have to call. They have in the state of Minnesota, we have six for 1.7 million employees. I believe the restaurant industry has... there's 200,000 or 150,000 people working there. But, you know, as a catalyst for this bill, you should probably increase the wage theft enforcement by at least a dozen people to get us up to what would be a national average of one inspector for at least 100,000 employees, which would just get us to a really poor national standard. So what is your plan for the Department of Labor and Industries budget in terms of wage enforcement agents?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, with regards to the number of wage enforcement agents we have, that's a conversation I'm willing to have to, again, get the bipartisan support that's additional bipartisan support that's necessary for this bill, so I'm open to suggestions of how to address that. Second of all, with regards to the administration aspect of it, again, I would point out that under current law, under the minimum wage bill that was passed last session, a second tier for minimum wage was set up with those same sorts of barriers to enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, you keep coming back to the two-tier of last year, and, you know, that's an easy soundbite. That particular piece was relatively uncomplicated. Complicated in many ways, but relatively compared to what you're talking about, is very, very uncomplicated. So it's kind of a, I don't want to call it bait and switch, because I don't think that's fair. You've been, you know, relatively fair with all of your proposals and in the committee. I don't always agree with you on the committee, but this is a really complicated system. I mean, it may sound simple, but it's very complicated. And if you are pushing this forward, you really do need to have a component that deals with wage theft, which is rampant nationwide, and certainly we're not immune to that in the state of Minnesota. I wouldn't put that onto any particular employer. So I hope you take a look at that. My question, though, is, you know, the state puts out last year we asked for a Minnesota cost of living study on a regional basis. Actually, I asked for a county by county basis, but I couldn't get that, so I had to settle for the 13 economic regions of the state. So statewide, the average, this is for a family of 2.5 with two people working. The statewide cost of living average is $18.15. Unfortunately, statewide, the average cost of wages earned is $16.34. But I'm going to go through a few of these, and because I'm making a statement, I'm not asking the question anymore, because I suspect there's about 14 votes to get this bill out of committee and to wherever you want it to go.
Well, Representative Mahoney, before you go through a lot of examples, there are a bunch of other folks on your side of the aisle that also have questions, so I just want to alert
you
to that.
I'll be relatively brief.
All right.
In northwestern Minnesota, the average cost of living requires a $13 an hour wage. In the Arrowhead, it's almost $14. In North Central, good for the Lake Country, they are above their area average at $14.70. East Central, $17.75 an hour. And in the metro area, it's almost $18 an hour. Now, these numbers are figured on two people working 30 hours or part-time. Your bill drives more people below the average cost of living requirements for a family of two. Why are we lowering wages for people rather than raising wages for people? And, you know, whether it's women or not, you know, I got two daughters, both feminists, and they beat the living snot out of me on a regular basis. So I don't want to go down that road too far, but I'll just be average. There's men and women that are servers. Why are we lowering the wages? I don't understand. Why do you want to lower the wages for Northwestern, the Headwaters, the Arrowhead, West Central, Southwest Minnesota, East Central Minnesota? All of these places, you're lowering the wages, and I don't understand. So what is the principle behind lowering this particular wage?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, there were a couple of questions that were in your statement. Number one, again, I would point out for employers in terms of burden, this is a voluntary situation. They do not have to use the two-tiered minimum wage for their business. Second of all, again, I've opened my door to say that if there are areas around the area of increased enforcement, not just for the two-tiered minimum wage, but existing wage laws, that's a conversation I'm willing to consider. Third and finally, Representative Mahoney, with regards to existing employees, There's no worse thing we can do than kill people's jobs. And what is happening right now, the unintended side effects of the current law, is that's exactly what's going to take place. You've heard from Mr. McElroy about what happened in Washington, what happened in Oregon, and that is something that we want to avoid in our state. Preserving jobs, allowing those jobs to grow, is a good thing for our state. Again, my door remains open. We have DFL support for this bill right now, but we're going to need more DFL support. So if you have ideas on what I can do to improve this and get this to a place where you can vote for it, my door remains open. I would point out, though, that under current law, the employee who makes $12 an hour is guaranteed a government-mandated wage increase, while the employee who makes $9.50 an hour is not. Now, if the stated purpose of the minimum wage increase, regardless of a person's opinion on it, is to take the bottom wages and rise them, that makes no sense. And if a person cannot accept the reality of $9.50 versus $12 in current law, then I can't negotiate and address their concerns. However, if a person does recognize those concerns and does recognize the burden it puts on many of the mom-and-pop businesses of the state, then my door remains open to work with you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to get through all the questions before the hour of noon, but I have Representatives Carlson, Hornstein, Liebling, Erdahl, and Albright. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I have several comments I want to make, and I hope it's not too repetitive, but maybe that last point I just want to comment on before I get into what I was initially going to comment on. You seem to like to point Representative Grafflo to DFL support for the bill. Let's make one thing very clear. That's very minimal in our caucus. We are a large caucus, 62 people. Not quite large enough in my view, but and in fact, if we were a little larger, this probably wouldn't be coming forward. But at any rate, that support is very minimal in my view, and I think we'll probably see on the House floor just how minimal that perhaps is. But a couple of points I want to make. If you read the bill carefully, this tip penalty freezes wages at $8 an hour. And there'd have to be a change in law to increase that, and quite frankly, the legislature is notoriously bad at, in a timely manner, adjusting the minimum wage when you look back. And so we would put tipped employees in that situation where it would take a change in law to get them above the $8. And sometimes years have gone by without a change in the minimum wage. One thing that I'm just trying to pick out a few of the things that I was going to comment on. One is, and Representative Hillstrom very clearly pointed out, and a lot of the conversation has been servers in restaurants, but there are a lot of tipped employees that would be covered by this law that are outside the restaurant industry. She listed off a few, and we could probably come up with a few more if we were to talk about that aspect of the bill a bit more. One thing that I do know is that this, and there's been a little discussion of this, I really think that it would be a good idea to have this gone to the Pension Commission, quite frankly, because pensions are often made, although they deal with public employees, but your pension is often based on your actual wages paid. And that would create an interesting dialogue in and of itself. And I'll use a personal example. My father was a railroad employee. He didn't receive the minimum wage, obviously, and he would have been covered under the collective bargaining agreement. But what I'm trying to show is how you can have a negative impact on pensions. Because he was a tipped employee, he was a baggage handler. The railroad, it was the Great Northern Railroad at the time, paid them less than any other employee on the railroad. The argument was they received tips. Well, when my father retired, his railroad retirement was much less than if he had gone on the road or actually even taken another position in the non-operating part of the railroad structure. And my mother lived to be almost 90 years old and received a much smaller pension because of what for them within that industry was a tip penalty. And I know the argument was made that by the author that this is not a tip penalty, but when you're freezing people at $8 an hour, it is a tip penalty. I did do a little research over the weekend and asked one of our staff people if they would print it out for me today. My numbers are a little bit different than what Representative Mahoney pointed out, but it's the same thing, and it's the $12 per hour does not create a livable wage, a living wage. I think that's important to understand, because we are treating this category of employees under this bill differently. We're still at $12 an hour, not getting them to a livable wage. If you're one adult with one child in Minnesota, that would take $19.81 in 2014 to have a livable wage. And by the way, there's information on how that's defined, and that's very restrictive, being that we're talking a lot about the restaurant industry. Livable wage doesn't include eating out at all. That's one of the points that was made, along with no vacations and any number of things that someone wanted to have a reasonably good life style are omitted when you're defining the or the livable wage. Now, at the $12 an hour, on a monthly basis, that gives you roughly $1,920. That livable wage takes $2,823 per month. So you're almost $1,000 below a livable wage if you're getting the full $12. So, you know, in fact, when we talk minimum wage, I've been an advocate for years of a livable wage. We don't talk enough about livable wage, in my view. That would take $41,000 a year for one adult, one child. I've got information here of different family sizes and if both are working and so on. But in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, I won't go through all of those. I've made the point with one adult and one child, but it's even more dramatic as you move with more children. And if you're one adult working or even two adults working. So I think this is a bad bill. It does not help grow the middle class. That's been a goal of many of us here in the legislature. I think both sides of the aisle give lip service, at least. Some of us strongly believe in trying to grow the middle class, but when you come in with policies like this, it's really a step backward for many thousands of employees. But I know we have at least one or two other members that want to comment as well. And by the way, employment has grown. There's no question about that since the minimum wage went in last summer. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there. But again, I think you've got a roll call on your list as being requested. So thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, a couple of things. First of all, you brought up the issue of the way the design of the bill exists, that there would that you would be supportive of inflationary increases in that amount. I think it's a conversation I'm willing to have. If you have suggested language, I'd be willing to talk with you about that. Second of all, you mentioned the number of DFLers in the House DFL, who, at least, who support this bill. You are correct that it's a minority of DFL members. However, there was unanimous DFL support for the two-tiered minimum wage that was put into law last session. Every DFLer voted for that provision, so there clearly is a recognition of that. And third and finally, again, I want to emphasize to members, because Representative Carlson brought up the pension issue, that those who are covered under collective bargaining agreements, this provision of law does not apply to them.
To that point, Representative Carlson.
It has an impact on Social Security. I happen to use one example because it, and by the way, my father's been deceased for many years, so I've not a vested interest on this question. But yes, he was under a collective bargaining agreement, but railroad retirement was less. That operates much like Social Security does. So anyone that would be working that's covered by a pension plan, whether it's in the private sector and receiving less, or somebody that's receiving Social Security, which would be virtually almost all workers, would be based on their actual earnings, and they would be receiving a smaller Social Security check as a result of what their actual earnings are. Now, some say that tips can be calculated into that. I don't know quite how that works. I think others have made comments here about how complicated the system is going to be already. But I'm just saying it does have a negative impact on pensions and or Social Security. depending on that worker's situation. And to just kind of use the excuse of, well, collective bargaining takes care of that, this is an industry that unfortunately doesn't have as many people under collective bargaining contracts as they probably should, and probably this may actually drive some of them into trying to get under a collective bargaining agreement so that they can at least get a livable wage. But that'll be up to organizing efforts in the laboring in the labor community. I just wanted to clarify that pension question. That's a real issue and a very important one.
I think I've got time for maybe another question from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm feeling a little deja vu. Last year we heard all of these arguments that, jobs would be cost if we passed the minimum wage, and there'd be all these different issues and problems, and now we're hearing this kind of these Chicken Little type of arguments again. And Oregon was mentioned in specific, and I have data from the National Restaurant Association that indicates that they're one of the fastest restaurant job growth states in the country. 14.7% projected growth in restaurant and food service jobs in Oregon between 2015 and 2025. So I think, again, this is the same kinds of scare tactics we heard last year, and I think we can vote no and feel confident that our restaurant industry will continue to grow along with the rest of the economy.
Representative Garofalo, any other last words on the bill or comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that, again, we need members of both the GOP and DFL to vote in favor of this for it to become law, and my door remains open to work with members of both sides of the aisle to address their concerns.
All right. Well, members, despite what the clock says, the hour really is noon. And so with the hour being noon, I will call for the vote. Representative Carlson has requested a roll call vote. Representative Garofalo renews his motion that House File 1027 be referred to the General Register. Clerk will take the roll.
Not Black.
Aye.
Albright.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Carlson.
No.
Cornish.
Aye.
Davids.
Aye.
Dean. Detmer.
Aye.
Graskowski.
Aye.
Garofalo.
Yes.
Gunther.
Aye.
Heckberth. Hamilton.
Aye.
Hillstrom.
No.
Hornstein.
No.
Kahn.
No.
Vincheski.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loon.
Aye.
Mahoney.
No.
McNamara.
Aye.
Murphy.
No.
Norness.
Aye.
Pulowski. Coffey. Perkelson. Erdahl.
Yes.
Wiginius.
There being 14 ayes and 9 nays, the bill is referred to the General Register. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.